On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Dr. Suzanne Gordon about Field Notes from the Light, an ethnographic study of the meaning and significance of near-death experiences.
Give people a sense for some of these cases. Maybe start with the atheist.
I was going to say, let's start with Eric. What happened to him was he was on the sailboat of a friend of his who was a cardiologist, conveniently enough, sailing out on the Chesapeake Bay, not far from where I live. And there was some accident. He ended up falling overboard, and it was a relatively cold day. So he died, you know, and he watched the resuscitation efforts on the boat below him. And then he was like floating away. He said, I was very happy wherever I was going. I'm not sure where I was going, but I was floating away. And he said, I was very happy to do that. I wasn't struggling to live. You know, I was very happy to keep going and see what happened. But they kept working on him, and they'd give up periodically, and then I'd work on him some more. And finally, they did bring him back. And he didn't become a religious guy or anything.
That's fascinating. But on the other hand, you know, there's a completely different way to read that account that I do. And that's that, to a certain extent, it's the ultimate attachment to a worldview, you know? So it's, I'm an atheist, I have this transformative experience, and now I know that life goes on, right? Because he does say that at the end. He goes, okay, I know that physical...
We go on. And I didn't know that before.
Right. So really, that totally blows apart your worldview. But I see somebody who's not willing to go very far. I mean, he's the ultimate agnostic, you know, like I encounter so often. It's like, well, you know, can't know for sure. Don't really know. We're kind of in the middle. Versus if you look at how our culture defines life, this experience should have completely
blown his mind.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, we welcome Dr. Suzanne Gordon, who has over several years plugged away at some rather amazing work into the near-death experience. Suzanne is a fantastic guest. I enjoyed talking to her. I only wish we could have gone on for hours and hours more. There's so many other interesting areas to her work that we weren't able to get into, but I do hope you appreciate what she brings here. And as I mention again in just a minute, if you are interested in Suzanne's work, then you might want to also check out the interview that she did over at Mysterious Universe. It really gets into some more depth on the cases, some just amazing stories that I think you might want to check out. But in the meantime, enjoy this conversation with Dr. Suzanne Gordon. Today we welcome Dr. Suzanne Gordon to Skeptico. Dr. Gordon is on the faculty at the University of Maryland and is here to talk about, among other things, her rather amazing dissertation titled Field Notes from the Light, an Ethnographic Study of the Meaning and Significance of Near-Death Experiences. Dr. Gordon, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Alex. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I thought we should start, obviously, talking about this research, because first I have to say that for anyone who hasn't heard of you or your work, I can give them a great reference point. And that's a tremendous interview you gave to the folks at Mysterious Universe. It's episode 713, if anyone is interested. And it really opened me up to a lot of things related to this work you've done in ethnographic, that is, cultural anthropology, and applying some of those methodologies to this topic of near-death experience. So can you just kind of give us a high-level view of what you did for your PhD dissertation?
Well, the interesting thing about ethnography, well, one of them, is that it's very time intensive. It's the method of cultural anthropology originated in anthropology of participant observation field work. So I spent, well, a decade on the dissertation, but there were two-year periods of full-time field work so that I was spending more time with other people who had near-death experiences than I was with my own family. And my approach person-centered ethnography or life history narrative-based ethnography to find out what the meaning of near-death experiences were to those who had them rather than to the, quote, experts, by saying, if you were going to tell someone your life story or write your autobiography, how would you organize it into chapters?
Yeah, I think that was a very interesting part of what I came to understand what you did, and that's that one of the barriers you found was you had to use this like an NDE phrase. Can you tell us about that and how you came to understand that? And I guess more importantly, how that factors into the larger mission that you find yourself on in terms of education from a medical standpoint about this experience, this phenomena?
Yeah. Let's see. The original thing that happened was the very first informant, I just had assumed at the point at which I started my research, I didn't realize the experience I'd had at the age of 36 and a half months exactly, was a near-death experience. So I didn't even know that I was an experiencer. I knew my mother had been.
So wait, I have to stop you there, Suzanne, because as you've kind of wandered into that personal story, it's fascinating. Why don't you spend a minute and tell us first about your mother's near-death experience, because that, I guess, to you in your formative years was so in your face, but then also how you came to understand about your own near-death experience. Because I don't want people to run off and go, oh, wow, this is really kind of kooky. There's all these connections. When you explain it, it's really very understandable and ordinary in a way in terms of the way these things unraveled.
Well, I was 10 and my mother bled. My mother miscarried and hemorrhaged, and they died on the table when they were prepping her for surgery. So when she came home from the hospital, I was at school, and when I wasn't even all the way in the bed, my parents' bedroom, when she said, "Suzanne, I'm not afraid of death anymore. I know where we go." And she had been, her mom had died when she was 4, so she was really just sort of terrified of death. She was one of those mothers that if you were in the emergency room, you know, getting sewn up or something, instead of being there beside you, she'd be in the hall with her head between her knees. So that was a profound statement. And then she described to me the beautiful colors and the sounds and everything. And she realized that she said, "I scared the hell out of the doctors because I guess they must have pronounced her. They'd stopped trying to resuscitate her and covered her up and everything." And she said, she wasn't looking at me at that moment. She said, "Well, I wasn't going to come back." And then she realized, she's talking to her 10-year-old daughter, "I mean, I didn't want to come back, but I heard you kids calling me." And her NDE was one of those, you know, all the bells and whistles, many of the components. And so when Raymond Moody's book got published almost 2 decades later, or, you know, over 15 years later, I said, Mom, look, that was a near-death experience you had." Still completely, I remember thinking about the experience I had during surgery when I was 3 years old, reading Moody's book. But because there was no tunnel in my experience, like everyone else in my study, I therefore knew that that experience had not been a near-death experience.
Right. And you say that because you had this strong bias of these fixed parameters that had to exist for it to be a near-death experience, right? So fast forward to your research, and then that becomes this like a near-death experience question, right?
My very first informant, at some point in the research, she had been referred to me by someone who knew she'd had a near-death experience. But like everyone in my research, NDE or near-death experience was not only not her preferred label for the experience, which led me to see that, you know, the model was really being problematized by the method that allowed me to get people who weren't already necessarily self-labeled near-death experiencers. I found people the way ethnographers do, by using my own networks, letting people know I'm interested in people who've had near-death experiences. So the first time I used the term NDE with this informant, this research participant, she said, "What's an NDE?" So right away, because one thing you do in ethnography is you try to not lead the informant in any way. which is why I chose the life history method, where I never asked about their NDE or called it an NDE after that first informant. I would introduce myself to people by saying, you know, I'm interested in people who've had experiences like near-death experiences, realizing that many people like me were unable, unwilling, you know, dead set against whatever, using that label. So that became important, that I wasn't finding people who were already were self-labeled near-death experiencers. Some of my people knew about that stuff. Some of them literally did not know about it. Because you know, I started my research in the mid-90s, and by that time, you know, in the mid-70s, late-70s, everybody knew what an NDE was. But because the model is flawed for the experience, in my opinion, as time went on, you know, we began to get this conflation of close brushes with death and near-death experiences. So you'd hear things like the Redskins, you know, had an NDE in the fourth quarter and stuff like that.
Right.
So it was important to find people who, you know, were not acculturated into the culture of near-death studies. So ultimately what I ended up with was 50 people, 10 of whom I used more of their life histories in my dissertation, so they became like my foregrounded informants. But of those 50, I think I don't have my tables right in front of me now, but about half of them I found through IN, so they became sort of my background group. The other half on my own. And it became very interesting because the model, the NDE model, became very problematized. And as a result of that research, realizing that we needed a separate organization for the benefit of experiencers, we ended up, two or three of us, Yolaine Stout, Linda Jacklin, and I think at the very beginning, began working toward and have now founded ASSIST, the American Center for the Integration of Spiritually Transformative Experiences, ACISTE, to benefit them. And the first thing we saw was we need to educate mental health professionals, spiritual guidance professionals, pastoral counselors. We need to educate the healthcare and mental health care providers of people who have these experiences so they don't get misdiagnosed with some mental disorder as a result of talking about their experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that also ties into another question I wanted to ask you, and that's about the role that your advisors played, your academic advisors played in your dissertation.
Well, probably, the most helpful, John Coey, who's an anthropologist whose interests like mine are culture and consciousness, was my mentor and my committee chair for my dissertation. So that was tremendous. Bruce Grayson was kind enough to be on my committee, traveling up for meetings from UVA, which was great because he's the dean of near-death studies and, by the way, is going to be our keynote speaker at this October's conference. And Dan Levitin, who was the founding president of the Association of Death Education and Counseling, who was there early on with that group, people like Robert Kastenbaum, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the early pioneers of the death awareness movement. When Dan had read my comp, and bless his heart, gave me high honors on it, which was a big thrill. He didn't say a word about, oh, this is good, Suzanne, or anything. He just tossed it across his desk at me and said, you need an organization for these people. So Yolaine Stout and I, who was a former president of the International Association of Near-Death Studies, when we were early on, you know, drawing up the articles of incorporation and everything, we would refer to Dan as sort of the father of ASSIST. Because I didn't want to start an association. I'd actually done a lot of consulting work with associations, and I knew a lot about, you know, about association work, and I wasn't that interested in doing it, but I knew he was right. I knew he was right.
Right. So one thing that fascinates me about that is taking aside the health education needs and the needs of the experiencers, which is, I don't mean at all to diminish that, and my tone was kind of being playful there, because there's a huge need. And the problem you mentioned about misdiagnosis is just so sad to think that someone could have this completely transformative, life-changing experience. And then when they do seek help, the person on the other end is so uneducated that they're completely misdiagnosing them, maybe giving them medicine or maybe sending them down some rabbit hole that's really going to cause major upset in their life. So that is so real and so important. But I want to pull it back a completely different level of kind of the skeptical angle that we look at things sometimes. And that's that, you know, when I was talking to Raymond Moody, I don't know, a few months back, he's been on the show a couple times, but he said this thing about, you know, NDEs are pre-scientific. And I kind of know what he means in one way. But the other thing that struck me when I was, you know, going through your research is there's nothing pre-scientific about Dr. Suzanne Gordon's work. I mean, here is just a fertile area for research, and somebody who just dives in and really, you know, you just can't, everywhere you reach, well, there's an opportunity over here for both further study, but also for helping people. There's an opportunity over here. These are all methods that are well established within the educational community, cultural anthropology. This is how we look at things, da, 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 da. There's nothing pre-scientific about what you're doing, other than the fact that there's about 1,000 research questions here that you could never get into. And I'm wondering what thoughts you might have about how we've kind of tainted this field. And we haven't done it, but other people have tainted it because it doesn't fit within their worldview. And how you play with this idea of what role science can really have in overcoming this stigma that is associated still a little bit with near-death experience research.
Well, I'm not sure what Dr. Moody even meant by that statement. I mean, other than maybe in, you know, these experiences have certainly predated Western science. But let me give you Dan's sort of fix on this piece, I think, is interesting. Dan Levitin, before he died 2 years ago this month, actually, I said, Dan, you weren't all that interested in the mental health needs of experiencers, were you? you see this, you know, these millions of people. I mean, we are estimating like maybe 13 million, somewhere between 4% and 8%, based on the Gallup polls of the population studied, have probably had NDEs, which puts the U.S. somewhere up, you know, somewhere 12 and 20 million or something.
Let's put a brief exclamation point on that. So there's 10 to 20 million people in the United States walking around, by our best estimate, using the best surveying methods we have, that have had a near-death experience. That's a significant number of people.
Right, exactly. And Dan had written a book called, he coined the term horrendous death, meaning intentional destruction of human life or biosphere, ecosystem life. And he wrote this book called Horrendous Death, Health and Social Well-being or something. There's a new edition with a slightly different title. And this was a policy book that Dan edited. And his whole point was the United States is history's greatest manufacturer and exporter of the weaponry of horrendous death, both militarily and in terms of development. Development in quotes. So he admitted it. Yeah, he saw these millions of people in every population where they've been studied as sort of this uncalled up army of global wealth. Because looking at the after effects of NDEs, he in the book, he had identified from all these policy experts' perspectives the value shifts that we needed to make in order to preserve the ability of our grandchildren to be able to breathe. I mean, his concern was, look what we're doing to the planet, you know, with this horrendous death machinery. Look what we're doing to the health of the planet. And so he identified these set of values that we needed to change from being materialistic to being altruistic to having a concern rather than making money perhaps having a concern for global wellness, the wellness of the planet and social well-being. And all the values that he'd identified, there was this direct match between these values and the value shifts that are among the after effects of near-death experiences. So he admitted, you know, he saw that these people needed support and an organizational platform to become visible to culture.
Tell you what, let's jump into, because I think we're talking around about the research, and which is great, because I think it's great to have this background, but give people a sense for some of these cases, because they're just amazing. There's an amazing variety of cases that you talk about in your dissertation. Maybe start with the atheist. I love
that
story.
I was going to say, let's start with Eric. I had everybody choose their own pseudonyms, because that's very informative about why people choose what pseudonyms and why. Well, this guy chose Eric because Eric Clapton, because he was a guitar player and he really liked Eric Clapton. And the interesting thing to me about his account was, I think it points to why it's important for experiencers to become visible. Because like he said, it didn't answer all my questions. In other words, it didn't make him a believer, you know, or anything. He was totally disinterested in my research. If it hadn't been that I had known his son was a neighbor of mine, and I would never have had Eric in the study, because as his son said, you got to interview my father because he's the most unlike other near-death experiencers, you know, that I can imagine.
Tell us about his case.
Well, he just, what happened to him was he was on the sailboat of a friend of his who was a cardiologist, conveniently enough, sailing out on the Chesapeake Bay, not far from where I live. And there was some accident. He was doing something at the side of the boat and ended up falling overboard. And it was a relatively cold day, so he was burdened by clothing. And he died, you know, and he watched the resuscitation efforts on the boat below him. And then he was like floating away. And some of the funny things were how people will describe the same elements, but differently very often. And his was really extreme because, you know, most people say, oh, this beautiful, glowing, loving light and these wonderful sounds, right? Eric said the light was too bright and the sounds were too loud. And then he said as soon as he thought that, it all modulated, became very comfortable. And he was just – he didn't see God, you know. And I don't know that any of my informants identified the being of light, you know, in deistic terms or specific religious terms. But he just said – he said I was very happy wherever I was going. I'm not sure where I was going, but I was floating away. And he said I was very happy to do that. I wasn't struggling to live. You know, I was very happy to keep going and see what happened. But they kept working on him, and they'd give up periodically, and I'd work on him some more and some more. And finally, they did bring him back. And he wasn't – didn't become a religious guy or anything. I think his wife and I both think that many of the choices he made afterwards probably did reflect changes from that experience. It was really funny because his wife fit more – I mean, the only reason he even knew it was a near-death experience is because she had read Ray Moody's book, you know, and pointed it out to him. But if it hadn't been for his son and his wife – I mean, he had no interest. He kept apologizing throughout the process, you know. I'm sorry. I'm just really not very interested. And I keep reassuring him, you know, I don't care. It's fine, you know.
That's fascinating. But on the other hand, you know, there's a completely different way to read that account that I do. And that's that to a certain extent, it's the ultimate attachment to a worldview, you know. So it's, I'm an atheist. I have this transformative experience. And now I know that life goes on, right? Because he does say that at the end. He goes, okay, I know that physical.
We go on.
And
I didn't know that before.
Right. So really, that totally blows apart your worldview. But I see somebody who's not willing to go very far. I mean, he's the ultimate agnostic, you know, like I encounter so often. It's like, well, you know, can't know for sure. Don't really know. We're kind of in the middle. Versus if you look at how our culture defines life, this experience should have completely
blown his mind.
Should have blown his mind, and it didn't. So I think there's kind of two ways to take that. And I wonder what thoughts you have on that in general and on this topic of personal transformation and how that's different for different people depending on where they're coming from. Or maybe there's other reasons why it is different.
No, I think that's really important. You know, your previous experiences in life and your cultural beliefs and values. And I did talk about this in my dissertation because he had had a very really awful, sort of awful, awful childhood, and had a lot of issues. And I think, you know, for him, and I think that those are the people, there are probably many, many, many more people like Eric out there that are not going to turn up to near-death studies or assist. Do you know what I mean? That we don't hear from.
Right.
But I think his case speaks to the need for experiences to be heard. Harking back to your interview with Chris Carter, you know, where he kept talking about the third rail.
Uh-huh.
You know, that we've got science on one side and religion on the other. Well, I want the third rail to be the voice of experiencers themselves, because I think their interpretations of the meanings of their experience speak back both to religion and to science. And don't let us fall into these sort of simplistic either-or versions of what's real.
Yeah, but then again, they let us fall into this soup of complete chaos in terms of coming to any understanding of this. You know, I go back to the story you mentioned about I came back, I heard you kids calling, and I came back for you, which is a wonderful story that we all, I think, take in and go, oh, wow, isn't that neat? And the love connection bond between a mother and her kids. But there's a million questions that fall from that about the nature of this afterlife. I mean,
and just to add on to that before we move on, every woman in my study who had small children at the time of the NDE had some version of that rationale for why they were back.
But what does that mean? And what does that mean? And why? And men didn't have that, or why didn't men have that? What are the cultural differences? You know, take that one step further. What does that mean about the nature of the afterlife, of this other realm, of this higher consciousness? Is it that random that you're just kind of, well, I could come back, I could not come back. Oh, this is wonderful. It's great. Oh, but I have the kids. What are our obligations to this life, to this world, to this material existence? You know, I mean, it raises so many more questions that really seem impossible to answer. Even if we use the accounts and try and compile them and sort them and sift them, I don't know that we're ever going to get much closer to that. And I think that is what ultimately people's heads spin enough, and then they kind of feel a need to grab onto one rail, science, or the other rail, you know, religion or some kind of spiritual belief, because that third rail, it's nonsensical in a lot of ways.
Well, in pre-quantum physics, it would be nonsensical. And to religion, unless your NDE happened to align with the precepts of a particular religion.
Which many of them do. I mean, we can't gloss over that. We can't gloss over that. One, many of them do. But even more importantly, almost all of them have this element of a moral imperative of some kind, whether it's just some connection to good or a connection to love or specific instructions to do well. So, you know, that moral imperative is another part of this third rail that we can't really process, and we can't even fit it into back. The mother wants to go back to their children, but what, she doesn't want to go to God, or what, you know, I mean,
nobody I talked to wanted to come back. Nobody wanted to come back. But, you know, when you were talking about that, you know, well, why do they come back? It reminded me this line of a poem. And now I can't remember if it was Wallace Stevenson's. I can't remember the author, who was the author of this poem was. But the line I wanted to quote was, love calls us to the things of this world. Love calls us to the things of this world. And I think that's what brought people back. I mean, many people articulated that, you know, one of the men in my study, I called him Neil, but it's Neville Johnston, who's written a couple books and who's, you know, so, you know, it's okay to mention his name. He was 27 and he was offered the opportunity to stay, and he was really enjoying it. I mean, his really interesting account, really, he was dead for a while. So there tends to be more narrative the longer that you're dead. But he was only 27 when he died. He hadn't really done anything yet. This was his thinking that he reported to me,
right.
That his, you know, he hadn't done anything yet. He was mom's only child, and he was only 27. And so he too felt obligated to come back.
Right. But Suzanne, that we have the ultimate filter on these accounts, right? I mean, if they decide,
the ones that came back.
If they decide not to come back, then we're really not going to interview them. And the other part that just, again, presents this problem is we hear two completely contradictory things. We hear on one hand, there's this decision to come back to take care of things in this world. And then we hear equally, at least I have, and I'm sure you have, you've researched this much more than I have, these accounts of everything here is as it should be. Everything is going to be okay. All those questions you had about human suffering, why bad things happen to good people, are answered for people in this other state of knowing, and it all makes sense, which would lead us to there's really no compelling need to do something. You know, it just kind of all works out, and you're just evolving and co-evolving with the process. Aren't those ideas really, I don't want to say they're in conflict, but they appear to be contradictory.
They do. So why is it that way? Why do people see this other side where on some level or from some perspective, it's all okay? And yet, the way these things change people's lives, there's the tendency to have a new or more pronounced sense of life, mission, responsibility, accountability to everyone on the planet and to the planet itself. You know, it is interesting, isn't it? It is, because if you see some place that seems so wonderful and where everything is clearly okay, and even a lot of times beings, you know, like with Danny and Brinkley, you know, he's done all these horrific things in his lifetime, and yet here's the being of light kind of with its arm around Danny and shoulder sort of saying, it's okay, it's okay. It's all a learning experience. It's all a learning experience. And yet you come back changed.
Right.
And wanting to do for others and realizing that, you know, things like we're here to learn and to serve and to grow.
Which are certainly wonderful things, but then those lead us back to, I think, that spiritual, back to our analogy of the rail, back to our spiritual, religious, wisdom traditions that put those foremost in terms of how we should live our lives too. So I don't know. I think this whole idea of NDE research is very tricky to balance this science objectivity with on the other hand, what seems to me this inevitable path towards the spiritual. And I know that's kind of a problematic word for you, and especially since you've started an organization about spiritually transformative experiences. Wander into that territory. Tell
Can
us about
I just say that was not anyone's first choice, but our original idea for the title was the Center for the Integration of Transformative Experiences. Period.
Yeah.
And that would have spelled site, right? CITE. And we all liked how that sounded, but that domain, that address was taken.
Well, it's also, it also doesn't ground you in anything. I mean, it's kind of like,
well, I didn't. Yeah, true. But I didn't like that word spiritual, because I never liked that word spiritual, because it sounds like there's spiritual over here. And then there's what, the profane over here? You know, I teach about Native American cultures, right? So I loved your Artie Clark interview. But in many Native American cultures, well, how sociology of religion would describe it is they would say religion is coextant with the culture itself. Mm. In other words, these are cultures that never deligioed or deligareed, or however you'd use that, you know, Latin verb, so they don't have to religio. Mm-hmm. And so we always struggle over that in studying Native American cultures, because people refer to Native American religions, and that's really a complete misnomer. But I don't like the word spiritual, because somebody who's had one of these experiences, or however they get to have this mindset, it's all spiritual, if you want to look at it that way. My own experience or understanding of my experience is more like quantum physics, you know, that it's consciousness that's really sort of prime rather than matter. So everything that we take to be outside of us in the material world is actually inside this consciousness that we think is transmitted by our brain. And I'm much more of the sort of quantum mechanics or where that perspective takes you, that the brain is the receiver of consciousness.
I'm with you on all that. We have two problems, in my opinion. And one is, you know, we do have a cultural paradigm that is totally against anything spiritual in the broadest sense of what you're talking about. It is diametrically opposed to that. And I think when we avoid talking about the spiritual, we're kind of ceding the debate to folks who really don't have a legitimacy, a scientific legitimacy in making those claims. I mean, if they had some kind of explanation for what's going on that made sense, then maybe they have a seat at the table, but they don't and they reject it. So I think we have that to sort out. But the other thing I think we have to sort out that I keep coming back to is, you know, this little moral imperative thing. I mean, what is going on there? We can process it any way we want and abstract it to, you know, one consciousness and consciousness being primary and not matter and all that. But there's still this connection with the experiencers on the broadest sense, as far as I know, have a sense of, and that's that there is a higher order of goodness, of love, of connection.
Yes.
And, you know, that to me sounds like spiritual in just about any way you want.
Yes, I agree. But, you know, here's something interesting for you that I didn't really realize till I started teaching courses in sociology of religion. This really surprised me that it isn't Zionists who don't have any sort of spiritual belief. I have this somewhere on a PowerPoint slide, but so I'm going to just approximate. But something like 87% of hard Zionists have some sort of spiritual belief system. Now, isn't that interesting?
That's
you know
surprising.
The group of Zionists who are the lowest in having any sort of belief system?
Psychologists.
Social scientists.
Oh, social scientists.
All the whole range of social scientists, because they sort of, you know, sociology sort of starts out on Marxist, you know, materialist worldview principles. This tension that we're always talking about between, you know, the spiritual or the religious and the scientific. And when you look at that statistic, well, wait a minute, 87, I think that's the figure. I have to go look it up. But 80 in the upper 80s% of Zionists have some sort of belief system. Now, this may not be orthodox belief systems, but some sort of faith or belief system related to this, as you put it, higher order of goodness or something, spiritual something. So it's interesting, isn't it? It's not science versus religion, but it's the pre-quantum scientific worldview versus the religious worldview, neither of which do I hold. And I worry, you know, because I can see sort of a new scientific paradigm that's just as sort of cold and, as hard scientists would say, you know, bias-free and value-neutral, which we don't buy in ethnography, by the way, in anthropology, because that's a statement of value to
right,
say your
right,
value,
right.
You know, and the utilitarian purposes to which science is being put and have been put, which can lead to very evil results. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, it's not as cut and dried as it seems to be when we talk about these two rails. But, you know, that's why I want the culture of people who have lost the fear of death but are not necessarily espousing orthodoxy. None of my research participants changed religions, but to the last, you know, they certainly have a much – like one of my informants, I think Jenny was her pseudonym, said she had been taking – she was something like Greek Orthodox. She was something else, and she was – she had a good friend who was a Catholic priest who was giving her catechism. She was going to be baptized as a Catholic. And it was her priest visiting her in the hospital who somehow put his face over hers that stopped her movement into the world of light. For 18 months, she said she hated him, and she didn't know why. She had no idea what had happened to her, none whatsoever. No idea what had happened to her. And then, but anyway, after the experience, she said, well, I went ahead, you know, after I got over being mad at the priest and realized I'd had a near-death experience. Someone had found her crying in the restroom at work and realized by what she said that she'd had a near-death experience and she connected with
just to clarify, she was mad at the priest because he had prevented her from moving into this wonderful realm. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right. But she ultimately did get baptized or whatever. And she said, you know, she said, I know that you don't have to be Catholic to connect with what I've connected with through the near-death experience. It's just comfortable for me, the incense and the candles and the rosary. But she said, but my beliefs are very different now. Like, she changed her whole backyard and made it into like a wildlife preserve, you know, sowing wildflower seeds and no chemicals and all that. And she said, and I realize now I have to take care of nature, even snakes. And I don't even like snakes. I thought that was really really interesting. So I mean, people, you know, stayed or went where they felt comfortable. And another informant, she's more like me, you know, she's sort of sampled around all kinds of different religions and paths and everything, but they don't, religion or spirituality for them is no longer about particular sets of dogma or belief.
You know, let's touch on one thing that you mentioned, a phrase that always kind of grabs my stomach a little bit, and that's fear of death, you know, because I understand the need to educate about fear of death. I understand the transformation that people go through that you mentioned from your research, and many near-death experience researchers have talked about that this transforms this experience, this near-death experience transforms people, and they no longer have this fear of death. But I wonder at the same time if we've elevated this symptom, i.e. fear of death, into something more that it is than to obscure kind of the underlying cause, which is kind of this worldview that we have that says, oh, you know, you are this biological robot, you are here, you are there. And, you know, fear of death being the thing that we have to kind of overcome, doesn't it kind of obscure maybe the worldview shift that someone has to go through to really totally take in what it means to survive your death?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you can't think your way out of fear of death, I don't think. You can't just use logic to walk out of fear of death. That, do you know what I mean? That's apples and oranges or something.
See, I don't know. I think you can to a certain extent.
Well, I know exposure. I mean, according to Ken Ring's work in Heading Toward Omega and Omega Point, that, you know, from the studies he did, just exposure to near-death studies literature alleviated, you know, lessened people's fear of death. So, right. Yeah, I think that's a good thing. But no, I agree with you. I think it's the experience of finding yourself alive while, you know, somebody's just pronounced your body dead, there's culture shock for you, Alex.
Right. So you have culture shock. And I guess I wasn't being totally clear, maybe too abstract there. But, you know, so you have, fear of death. No, I no longer have fear of death because I reached this other realm. Okay. Well, now incorporate in reincarnation into that. Okay. So you're going to come back. How many times are you going to come back? To incorporate into that karma, if you believe in karma, incorporate that into that this idea of moral imperative, and that you have to do right by other people or do right by the parallel. I mean, there's an endless number of kind of worldview shifts that one can make either one way or another that all would factor into this fear of death kind of question. I understand fear of death because the way we've organized our society, our culture, is kind of a big barrier. But it seems to me like the tip of the iceberg. There's millions upon hundreds of millions of people around the planet who are already, as you may, are already past the you don't die and you survive your consciousness. And they still have fear of all sorts of things, you know, in terms of their karmic future or their reincarnation. So It's a lot more complicated than just overcoming fear of death, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, my experience with this population is that they're a lot less fearful about a lot of stuff than other folks.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, yeah. Yeah. Because they've experienced a different, let's say, I don't even know. I'm none of the terms right up there with spiritual planes of dimension, planes of reality or right. dimensions. You know, I don't know about many of our, I mean, all this terminology came out of this already material worldview, you know,
yes,
but,
exactly.
but yeah, but they've experienced a different reality or, you know, and for anthropologists, it's easier to say they have experienced a different culture and they have experienced profound culture shock when they get there and profound counter shock when they get back. One of my informants, Chris, her pseudonym was, she did the Christopher Reeves thing, as she put it. And when she came back, when she was back with her family, she kept asking them things like, why are you talking to each other like this? Why are you talking to each other like this? And they thought she was crazy because that's how they'd always talk to each other. But suddenly she was hearing it very differently. And she's one of the people who went for counseling. And I should point out too that, and didn't get, you know, there was no connection made between the experience. But she's one of the people who to this day says it wasn't a near-death experience. She knew she wasn't going to die. But, you know, so none of the five of my 10 foregrounded informants who sought some kind of counseling after knew to describe their presenting symptoms or whatever you call it in a clinical context as related to their near-death experience. And then none of their mental health care clinicians knew to connect it either. Mm-hmm. So there were all sorts of other kinds of diagnoses, you know.
Which is that whole medical education problem, you know, which right. leads us back maybe to the group that you've formed or the association that you've formed. Tell us a little bit more about that and particularly about this conference, this meeting that's coming up in October. Again, it's the American Center for the Integration of Spiritually Transformative Experiences. We'll certainly have a link up in the show notes to it. But tell us a little bit about what's going on.
It's ACISTE. So you can Google that and we come up first. Well, we're excited about this conference. I'm very excited. Bruce Grayson is going to be our keynote speaker. And we have all new speakers this year. But what the conference focuses on are the therapeutic issues connected with these kinds of experiences. So what do mental health care providers need to know? And it's really interesting because at our first conference last year, sorry, I'm looking at my bookmarks menu right now to go to our assist website. We have a lot of people coming to these conferences who are mental health professionals who have had themselves had transformational experiences one way or the other, whether it was, you know.
Yeah. Tell us what are some of the kinds of transformational experiences that you're typically, you know, dealing with?
Wow, there's all kinds of them. I mean, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of triggers for these experiences. We just realized early on that many of the experiences being studied in near-death studies, we couldn't even really be sure of the clinical state of the person being studied. But let me see here. There are many types and many names for experiences that can share common features and be catalysts for spiritual transformation, not just NDEs, but we also say near-death-like experiences, out-of-body experiences, visions, spiritual emergencies, awakenings, kundalini experiences, enlightenment experiences, probably the same thing. Other terms, exceptional human experiences, pre-birth memories, past life experiences, nearing-death awareness, which is a term that Maggie Callanan and Patricia Kelly coined for their work with hospice patients, right. where they saw that people, they called it nearing death awareness because like where near death experience would typically happen all at one time. As Maggie said to me once, never sit in an empty chair in a hospice bedroom until you make sure Uncle Fred's not sitting there. Mm-hmm. Apparently in the nearing death awareness, what they found was people would have many of the elements of NDEs in a natural death trajectory, like in a hospice situation, but they'd be spread out over a period of weeks or months. So after death communications, empathic or shared near death experiences, which is it Moody who wrote about that or Morse?
Moody.
At peak experiences, STEs include or may be called numinous, noetic, transcendent, transpersonal, mystical, anomalous, religious, paranormal. I mean, and some experiences, occur after meditation, yoga, drugs, religious practices, dance, drumming, sensory deprivation, prayer. Sometimes they happen spontaneously. Personal trauma, illness, distress, crisis. They can occur during emotionally intense periods. At one point, I read something in the near-death studies literature that at some point someone had estimated, based on the incidence of different sort of clinical symptoms in relation to NDEs, that it looked like about 75% of women's were childbirth related, and about 75% of men's were cardiac related, because women actually who give birth come close to death earlier than men who don't give birth. You know, I think we don't realize how close those two things are. There seem to be a lot of triggers. Now, the thing is, most of the research we've done has been on near-death experiences. So there needs to be, there's such a need for research on these kinds of experiences in other contexts. Because for me, sort of the two earmarks for me of the near-death experience are loss of fear of death, which in our culture is a monumental thing to realize that dying did for somebody, mm-hmm. and that sense of spiritual mission or life purpose. So, but we don't know enough about, I mean, even alien encounter experiences, you know, I mean, Ken Ring found a lot of the same after effect patterns with alien encounter experiences, right, as with near-death experiences, which we talked a little bit about before.
Right.
So it's really a wide open field for research. And thank God for quantum mechanics. Thank God for quantum. That's funny. Thank God for quantum mechanics, because that's sort of what and recent brain mind research and, you know, this whole growing body of knowledge we have from quantum mechanics have both legitimated more that the near-death experiencer's worldview, that, you know, there are more dimensions. And I think we talked about this last time, that our culture, according to Elizabeth Satoris, have you had her on?
Yes, long time ago.
Fascinating person. Our culture has the fewest dimensions of any culture in its worldview, mm-hmm. of any culture studied by either anthropology or evolutionary biology. And I think that's really interesting. So now you have, you know, quantum theories coming over here and saying, well, we've got to have at least 11 dimensions. And, mm-hmm. You know, so you just sort of – and brain mind research, which is Bruce Grayson points out, we do not have an explanation for people, you know, reporting accurately things that have happened when they were flatlined, because that does not fit our material model of the brain being the transmitter of consciousness rather than the receiver.
Right. Well, I mean, we keep flipping back and forth between trying to explain things from this perspective of,
yes,
you know,
I think you need, I want the culture of near-death experiencers to become visible. Because I can envision just as cold and value neutral and bias free a worldview emerging out of quantum physics that still allows us to completely trash the planet and each other.
I agree.
So yeah. Yeah.
That
just really occurred to me last night when I was thinking about the interview today, that, like, yeah, you could bring yourselves we could develop for ourselves an expanded worldview, but that just almost lets us, you know, trash everything out here with greater sense of impunity.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's something we have to be very careful that we don't advocate for. I call it the backdoor materialism, you know.
Yeah. Oh, say more. I like that.
Well, I think, unfortunately, even very valid, worthy causes like environmental concerns have an element of backdoor materialism to them, because they suggest that we can do. Oh, we've made a mistake, but that's okay. We can fix it just by doing more. Convert that coal to hydroelectric or whatever, when a spiritual first perspective, and I mean that in a non-religious sense, but in a whatever that other meaning of the world is,
yes,
might suggest that it's not about that. And this is what NDEers really tell us, right? They come back and they say, No, 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 no. It's really not about that. If you want to get out there and march and protest, that's okay. But what it really was about, this is my understanding, was, you know, when you smiled at that person when you're crossing the street, you don't know what that did, but that made a connection with them that affected their whole life. And that's all you need to worry about anyway, because this idea you have about time and about before and about after and about later is really kind of not the way that it is. So I don't know.
It hasn't made me any less of an activist. I'll tell, or you know what I mean?
No, nor has it made me. It's made me more of an activist.
But right.
It's made me much more humble about one, what that activism means, and two, it's made me reflect on what are the underlying motivations and needs that I have to act, you know?
Right.
It can get very religious very quick. It can get very Jesus in that, you know, the only true act that you can do is when you, and I'm not enough of a scholar on that to know, but, you know, when you totally are unattached, which is a very Buddhist thing, to the outcome, you know, no one knows your charity. That's the only charity, you know? Well, who can really do that, you know? But
yeah.
Buddhists say the same thing. When you do, and you're totally not attached to what you're doing, then, you know, that's the only true doing that you can do. Again, I don't know. I lose it there.
Yeah, I hear you. I like that. I like that idea that just, you know, a little more humility about what we can do or what we think we can do. And it is really true that again and again, you hear experiencers say, adult experiencers, I mean, there was no before for me. So, you know, say that, you know, it's not those big accomplishments that you thought you were supposed to set out to have that matter. It's what you do every day, as you suggested before, that you, the person that you smile at, that how you are on a day-to-day basis that really, really matters.
Well, Suzanne, this is just an amazing body of work that you've compiled and are continuing to compile. There's a book here. So let's get that book out, Suzanne, so we can share that with even more people. Do you have any prospects for writing a book on this?
It's just time mainly. You know, I'm one of the army of non-tenure track faculty that's now the majority on our college campuses.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and I'm so glad that this is, you know, receiving attention. And thank goodness the University of Maryland is a little bit ahead of the curve in trying to deal with it. But what it really means is we teach the courses that have the most grading and take the most work. So finding time is really difficult. Right now, I'm just working on revising the presentation I gave at the last Assist conference because it's going to be a we're going to have a special edition of the Journal of Near-Death Studies for the papers from our first conference.
Great.
So that's taken a chunk of time today. But I was just looking for this quote while you were talking, something I found and shared on Facebook the other day called The Case for Hope. If you take the long view, you'll see how startlingly, how unexpectedly, but regularly things do change. Not by magic, but by the incremental effect of countless acts of courage, love, and commitment. The small drops that wear away stones and carve new landscapes. And sometimes by torrents of popular will that change the world suddenly. To say that is not to say that it will all come out fine in the end regardless. I'm just telling you that everything is in motion, and sometimes we are ourselves that movement.
Great. Who's that by?
This is Rebecca Solnit in an article called The Case for Hope Continued, Solnit.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dr. Gordon, that might be a great way to leave it. It's been a great pleasure having you on Skeptico. Best of luck with all that work. We'll certainly have a link up to the Assist conference coming up in October. Thanks again for joining me on Skeptico.
It was a delight.
Thanks again to Dr. Gordon for joining me today on Skeptico. I do have one question that I tee up as a result of this interview, and that is, what areas of near-death experience science of the phenomena do you think offer the most promise for further research? So Suzanne and I touched on some of the unanswered research questions that are out there but I'd be interested in hearing what you think are the most pressing research questions that really could be tackled if someone wanted to put their mind to it. So give me your thoughts on that. The place to do it is at the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can leave a comment right there or bounce on over to our forum where I'm often responding to listeners' comments and ideas. That's available through a link from the website, or drop me an email or connect with me on Facebook. While you're at the website, be sure to check out our over 200 previous shows of Skeptico, all available there for free for you to dive into. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. I have some great shows coming up, a couple of twists and turns that I'll leave just kind of hanging out there, but I do hope you'll stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.